You're listening to WJRH 104.9 FM, Lafayette College Radio, Eastern Pennsylvania. This is Remix Tape.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Remix Tape. I am Lindsay Ceballos. I'm the host of Remix Tape. This is a show, a variety show, in which we bring on members of the Lafayette community, but also the Greater Easton community, as we call it. People come on, they come on with a mixtape that is organized around a theme. And then we end up talking about their theme, their lives, their musical interests and tastes. And today we have Paul Barclay, or if you like, Professor Paul Barclay, Professor of History, joining us on the show today. Would you like to introduce yourself, Paul?
Sure. I'm a history teacher. I've been working at Lafayette for 17 or 18 years. I mainly teach East Asian history, but I have an interest in world history, and we're experimenting with the history of music in one of my courses this semester, which sort of brought me to the radio show. And I think there's not much more than that. I like to play music, but I'm not very good at it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I love to play music too, but I don't feel like I'm very good at it. And I guess I've been at Lafayette for about a year, and Paul and I work in the same office, so I get a chance to talk about music with him in these common areas. And one thing that we consistently talk about is jazz, so I'm really pleased today that he has come with a mixtape about that is featuring jazz musicians, some of the greatest that have ever lived. Do you want to talk about your theme for today?
Yes, I do. So maybe this is an academic habit, but when Lindsay asked me to make a mixtape, I wanted to have a thesis. And I know this is really a way to make fun music less fun, but I got the question while I was listening to Random Access Memory, that Daft Punk album that won a bunch of awards a couple years ago. And there's this recording on there where Giorgio Moroder, who arranged the kind of Donna Summer songs and did things with a Moog synthesizer, is relating his musical biography to Guimon and Thomas of Daft Punk. And he's talking about the click track. And the click track is a mechanical kind of metronome that people use in recording studios to set a rhythmic foundation for a multi-track recording. So different musicians can come in and synchronize to this click track, which is produced by a machine. And what Moroder did with a click track was kind of amazing. And I like his music, but he talked about it as the sound of the future.
Mm.
And he was looking at this from the vantage point of the early 70s. He thought maybe this could be the sound of the future. And so I thought about, well, what happened in the wake of him saying that? Well, albums like Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, things by David Bowie, but also I think even things by Walter Wendy Carlos a little before that. But all of the things that are enabled by this layered sound and multi-track studios is thanks to the click track in a way. And so my idea is I wanted to pick a set for this show called Interplay, mm-hmm. which is what I'm calling the set. And these are songs that I think could not be made with a click track. Because as I thought of the click track, I thought once you lay down your track and you leave the studio, you can no longer react to the other musicians. So the click track enables a lot of things, but it also disables other things. And one of them is listening to the people in the room. So this set is titled Interplay because I believe, at least at first blush, that these are songs that require a high degree of listening to the people that are playing with you, not people that deposited things on a record or a track.
I really like this theme, and it made me think initially about why jazz and maybe classical music as genres lend themselves maybe the best to this theme of interplay, and whether there are any maybe more popular genres where we could see a mix that is still centered on, I guess, a non-click track philosophy, but that are not from such spontaneous but also technical conversational styles of music as jazz and classical. Do you think it's possible to have an interplay of, you know, house music or something like that, which we would think to be extremely click tracky?
Well, I think so. I mean, when I got excited about hip hop, and I don't want to date myself too much, but this would have been the early 80s.
Yeah.
I like the way there's often sort of a lead rhymer or rapper, if you will, but there's always a second or a third kind of jumping in there and goading him. And there's a lot of call and response. And yet underneath them is kind of the very definition of click track. But so I think the two can exist together.
Yeah. Okay. I think, so we'll have more to talk about with this theme. There's a lot of, as I said, intense, important musicians on Paul's mix. We're going to start off with, do you want to say anything about the next block of songs initially, or should we play them and then talk about them afterwards? Or did you want to say anything about Mingus, this Mingus track that we first heard, which is Hog Collin' Blues?
Well, the Mingus track I picked because this is in the late 60s, and a lot of you know that Mingus was a great bass player, but he didn't play bass on that. He led a band and played piano, and that was kind of the fruition of his jazz workshop, which was they would start with rigorous practices, and they were well-rehearsed, but then the song itself was very loosely composed. And so at that level of musicianship, you can have that informality. I think that speaks to your comment, is that, you know, and so I thought, but as I listened to that one, I think that, you know, that it's debatable whether or not the rhythm could be clicked. But the next two songs are drummers and melodic musicians in duets, and the first one is John McLaughlin and Billy Cobham, and then there'll be Interstellar Space by Coltrane himself. That would be the next block, and I think it's a good time to play them.
Okay, great. So let's hear these next songs from Paul's mix, Interplay.
Thank you. 101 there.
Hey, we're back on Remix Tape. Paul, do you want to tell us what we just heard and fill in with any commentary about these songs, that how these songs speak to your theme and just what you really love about them, if you want?
Well, I will then. They were both duets. The first one was Johnny McLaughlin, a jazz guitar player who was also a fusion pioneer, and Billy Cobham, doing a song called Phenomenon Compulsion. And I always enjoyed that song for the drum work, but it's scripted and initiated by a guitarist, and it's on an album called Electric Guitarist. there's a lot of listening going on that song, and that I think it's very... For me, I enjoy listening to the drums following this guitar work that doesn't follow any meter or time signature that I can tell. But then again, on repeated listenings, as we were discussing while it was playing, probably the guitar player is not really listening to the drummer at all. So that isn't kind of the illusion of freedom. So there's no chronometric discipline there in terms of time signature, but there is a lot of sort of rigor and control bleeding through there. And so that's why the next song by John Coltrane, Jupiter, with Rashid Ali, I believe that's the drummer's name. I should have looked it up, but this isn't Elvin Jones. It's after the Elvin Jones period. And I think this duet is much more about interplay. And I think that I'm still wrapping my mind around that song, listening to it for the last 10 years. But that is Coltrane breaking free from piano, bass, and anything that would have harmonic interference in making these chords with these sheets of sound, and then a drummer that couldn't communicate with that.
We were talking about structure as you out there were listening to these tracks. In the first case with this guitar drum duet, we had... you were talking about a notion of structure that was kind of about a cult of personality, about some sort of dictatorship of structure, even though it's only two people. One person is leading the song and the other one's following. It's not necessarily a conversation. With your Coltrane track, Jupiter, there's absolutely no structural or kind of melodic thing holding it together. I mean, it's free. Why do you think that this Coltrane track is so much more authentic example of interplay, or maybe a quintessential example of interplay, and this other duet with the guitar and drums isn't? Does it have to do with structure, or is it this problem of conversation?
I think it might have to do even with the sort of structural position of electric guitars and tenor saxophones in the history of modern music. I think McLaughlin was playing at the apex of the guitar hero kind of phase, and I don't think he was ever able to break away from that. I think it's part of the training, and it becomes part of who you are as a musician, whereas I think Coltrane had nothing probably left to prove or even to do by the time he made Interstellar Space. So I feel that there's not a lot of structure there, but there is a refrain. There is a theme that keeps creeping back in that holds it together, and so I don't feel that song sort of compels him to be a virtuoso. I think that maybe that lack of having something to prove. I feel like Johnny McLaughlin's always auditioning to make the band almost, whereas I don't get that feeling from Coltrane. Personally.
Yeah, no, I didn't either. And part of me thinks maybe we as listeners are conditioned to even think of it that way because we have certain associations with certain instruments. I don't know what generally we think about when we think about tenor sax or just the saxophone in general. But with the guitar, it's for some reason, like you said, it does correspond at times to a historical period, but also to a kind of personality. And that, I think, makes it easier for us to bring a kind of judgment to our listening. Saxophone is more kind of like a vocalist in the sense that it can be a more maybe individualized performance, or it can read that way much more easily. And I think that affects the extent to which we have a balanced interplay or conversation going on in a duet situation. And that's a weird, to me, I mean, and probably to our listeners, that a duet between a saxophone and a drum is unusual.
Well, it's
especially people who aren't familiar with this freer kind of jazz.
Well, and later on we'll hear what that would sound like if you put a string bass in it with the conclusion. Albert Ayler is the punchline to this long, torturous joke, and we can get there. Should we cue up the next duet?
Sure, yeah. So we're going to hear the next song on Paul's mix, Interplay. So stick around. More to come.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. My mind is a little full after listening to this extremely complex and beautiful mix that Paul's come in with. Paul, do you want to go through with us what we just heard and give us your liner notes?
Well, the one that just finished playing is a song called Epistrophe. It's a Thelonious Monk composition, and that was recorded live at Carnegie Hall with John Coltrane sitting in. And the one before it was a duet between Anthony Braxton and Muhal Richard Abrams. And the Maple Leaf Rag was interesting to me because, to me, listening to that piano piece, which I think a lot of you know, I never thought there would be any room in a ragtime piece for a saxophone player to actually embroider something that seemed already embroidered. I think ragtime is, well, jazz used to be just called ragtime because the rhythm is torn up like a rag.
Yeah.
And so you've got march time and waltz time fused. But then you have Anthony Braxton coming in and he's following the piano part, but then he starts playing around it and enveloping it, and he's below it, he's above it, he's around it, and I think that's a kind of a virtuosity. But as I listen to that cut, I actually don't think either one of them had any sheet music. I think they just did that on a lark. And I like that playfulness, but then and then getting into the discussion we had, though, at what level of competence or your ability to have empathy does one have to reach to have that sort of non-scripted interaction? I mean, obviously these musicians had worked together for a long time to reach that. And then I think with Monk and Coltrane, we see an even a different, more complicated level of that combination of familiarity, discipline, and rehearsal and sophistication. Then when it gets to that point, then you don't need rules almost to do something beautiful, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it's because your connection with that person is the structure itself.
Right. And then why would they have a connection? Well, maybe they're both musical geniuses and proficient technically and proficient harmonically, compositionally, but also as whole people. And so, you know, we were talking about this. Well, if that had any implications for social organization, what does that say about our potential for, you know, living in a world with fewer rules or time signatures? Would we have to reach a certain level of empathy or familiarity? And then that makes you think, well, maybe smaller face-to-face societies didn't need laws because they could have that empathy. And I don't know, maybe that's a stretch.
Maybe so. Well, I don't know. I think Wynton Marsalis would. I feel like Wynton Marsalis, for many people in the U.S., is this kind of spokesperson for jazz, and it's. I think he's the person to maybe try to weigh your theory. If anyone public figure who's into jazz would be sympathetic, I think it would be him. I mean, he's such an advocate for young people playing jazz. I think for this reason, because he thinks that there's something about it that makes communities healthier, or that makes people empathize better with one another. And I think the theme of your mix is kind of getting at that, this, you know, example about an organizing principle for society that is coming out of interplay is what.
The ability to actually listen and be, I guess, to display a kind of competency or virtuosity through listening. I mean, the art of not being on offense in a way that might be counterintuitive in an acquisitive society that's kind of based on the idea of continuous improvement and competition, that other idea. Maybe that's why people want to get young people into music, is that demand for empathy and listening could be an aspect of it.
Yeah, I think it has something to teach us about our interactions in the world. I mean, one thing I wanted to pick up on something you said briefly. We can listen to the rest of your mix shortly, but you mentioned something about genius, and it seems to me that there's a kind of contradiction here, that if we've just listened to these songs, in which I think it's hard not to see the genius musicianship of these performers. However, what's making that happen is this kind of collective as you said, listening, this process of listening to one another that's generating this feeling as well. And it just seems to me that these things are not normally thought about in the same vein. That is, being a genius, having this level, this kind of magical ability as a performer, and being able to listen to other people who maybe are at that level as well.
Well, I think the mythology and folklore that surrounds the figure of the genius has been undermined by people that actually study so-called geniuses. It always turns out that Einstein or Watson and Crick or whomever has been embedded in a fabric, and they have a team of unacknowledged collaborators, and that it's much less heroic than it's been made out to be. And maybe that could be transferred to that musical moment, that the difference between a Coltrane and the person you never heard of might have a lot to do with different kinds of contexts and interpersonal skills that don't necessarily get folded into the narrative of the genius.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of one of my feelings about that notion of genius.
Yeah. Well, it's something that interests me, so I thought I would see what you thought.
Well, I tried to make it uninteresting by saying that.
No, it is interesting. I'm just so stuck thinking about genius poets, not genius musicians. His music is so much harder to think and talk about to me.
I see.
So let's hear the next part. And then we're soon approaching the end of our show. There's not enough time to get into how complex and really kind of mind-blowing some of this music is, which is the nature of jazz, I think. But yeah, so let's hear the next few songs, everybody, and then we'll talk about them.
I do remember one thing. It took hours and hours, and by the time I was done with it, I was so involved, I didn't know what to think. I carried it around with me for days and days, playing little games, like not looking at it for a whole day, and then looking at it to see if I still liked it. I did! myself when under stress. I repeat myself when under stress. I repeat myself when under stress. I repeat myself when under stress. I repeat. The more I look at it, the more I like it. I do think it's good. The fact is, no matter how closely I study it, no matter how I take it apart, no matter how I break it down, it remains consistent. I wish you were here to see it!
Thank you.
Hey everyone, we're back with Remix Tape with Paul's mix on Interplay. Do you want to go through the last few songs we just heard from your mix, rounding out your mix on Interplay?
Well, sure. The last song we heard, which is probably the most notable, is by Albert Ayler from his album Spiritual Unity, and that was a trio, a drum, a tenor sax, and a bass, an acoustic bass. And Albert Ayler, for my mind, really sort of captured and crystallized what the free jazz movement was trying to do, which was they completely destroyed the charts, the time signatures, the chord changes, and they reached a level of interplay that I don't know if I've heard it reached since then. I hate to be a nostalgic person that way, but that was a kind of a moment, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And his songs are kind of marches. They're band music, and then they turn into this very interesting meditation, I think, on the history of the 1960s. I think everything that's happening in the United States is in that song. And so that's why I picked it. A Night in Tunisia by Charlie Parker. I don't know if that song needs any glossing. I think that particular version, everybody is just plugged in. It's just amazing. I think, yeah. I'd put that on any show, no matter what it was.
Yeah, I love that track.
And then I threw in a rock song called Indiscipline, because I think the jazz theme is the main one, but in my estimation, that song Indiscipline has a drummer, Bill Bruford, that probably could have played with these other bands in terms of his ability to track everybody with all those moving parts and to make that work. And then I think the rest of it, you would quickly learn that the rest of it isn't, it could be reproduced by other people, but not that part.
Yeah.
So it looks like indiscipline, but it's probably just lack of discipline in some ways, and that there's a lot of cliches that crept into that one. But I still like it.
Yeah, I think, I guess when we're coming to the end of the show, I had like a couple of thoughts about major themes that have come out of this mixed theme interplay. The first is, Paul's talked a lot, either off air or on air, about not reading music, about not having an awareness of this way that we have, as human beings, come to structure our learning, of music and the way that we play together. Is that a necessary thing in interplay to a certain extent, or is that a value that we really privilege about jazz or about music in general, this facility without a kind of education or formation in musical structure? That's one question. My other question is, what are we going to do with the guitar? Why is the guitar always like frustrating interplay or making us confused about whether it's happening or not? Are we playing with the guitar player? Is the guitar player playing with us? Are we backing him up or her? There's so many things here, even just gendered things that I think assumptions we make about the guitar and its kind of dictatorial status in an ensemble that have come out of this conversation. So any thoughts about that or anything else you wanted to talk about?
Well, I think on guitars, I would just recommend listening to Mississippi. John Hurt is one of maybe...
It's three, never a bad idea.
Well, I mean, it's one of maybe three non-aggressive
right.
Sort of polluting guitar players that have a name, or maybe Wes Montgomery, but I think the guitar is a thing. It's a... There's a lot there to talk about. I don't even know how to deal with it. But I think this question about who can read and who cannot read music and whether that is sort of a window into spontaneity or authenticity or a kind of something fresh or something to be valued, of course, that only has value because we have been reading music for so long.
Yeah.
And that dialectic is part of every conversation about jazz. Can that person read? Could Mingus read music? And if he couldn't, is there something wrong there or is there something extra there? And maybe we've overdone it with the reading. I don't know. There's a lot to think about there.
It is. These are huge questions about music in general, but that I think for me were part of just my interest in jazz growing up playing it and listening to it, which is why I'm glad that Paul Breton, a lot of jazz that I haven't heard before, that I'm not familiar with, and I'm excited that I could hear it, and I hope that you liked hearing it too. And I hope you had a good time on the show, Paul.
I did.
Cool. I thought it was fun. We talked about, this is always what it's like with Paul, talking about kind of serious intellectual things. So come to Raymer House and talk with us about stuff sometimes. Not just about jazz, but who knows what else.
Yeah.
So thank you for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
So we have next week a colleague from this, we have more historians. We'll have Josh Sanborn coming on with his mix. I think he's still figuring out his theme, but I will post it on our Twitter where you can follow us at @re_mixtape. I post random things about music, new records that are coming out, but also fun stuff that's film and writing related in our area and in the world. So, thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back next week, same time, same place, on 104.9 FM WJRH here in Easton, Pennsylvania. This has been Remix Tape. Stay rad.